Today on Maine Calling, the American Dream. For generations, we've pursued what's become known as the American Dream, the idea that anything can be achieved through hard work, that anyone can make a better life for themselves and their children. Some would argue that the American Dream is increasingly out of reach, or is altogether dead. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll explore the origins of the phrase, the evolution of its meaning over time, and how it applies to the world at present. What does the American Dream mean to you? Is it about the promise of a house with a picket fence, a steady job, and a nice car? The freedom to pursue life in your own way? Or something else? And who among us gets to pursue this dream? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The American Dream, a single-family home, white picket fence, two cars in the driveway. Or does it simply mean having the freedom to be whatever you want to be? Has your idea of the American Dream changed over the years? That's our topic for today. Joining me for the hour, Dr. Libby Bischoff, professor of history and university historian at the University of Southern Maine. Dr. Eric Nelson is a professor of economics at Bowdoin College. And Michael Cauvel is also at USM. He's an associate professor of economics. We invite you to join the conversation, as always. What comes to mind for you when you hear the phrase, the American Dream? Send an email, talk@mainpublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. Let's begin this discussion with what it means, what we mean by the American Dream, with some historical context for the origins of this phrase. Libby Bischoff, by most accounts, the term American Dream is attributed to someone named James Truslow Adams in a 1931 book, Epic of America. Who was Adams, and what was he saying at that time of the Great Depression?
Sure. Good morning. Thanks, Keith. Adams is an historian, but before he's an historian, he's actually a really successful stockbroker. So he does an MA in history at Yale. He comes up in the stock market. He makes a good amount of money. And by, you know, the early 19-teens, decides that he can leave that career and pursue what he actually wants to be as a writer and a historian. And he actually becomes a Pulitzer Prize winning historian for like a 3-volume narrative history of New England. But this book, The Epic of America, is his like 1931 attempt at a 1-volume history aimed at a really popular audience. It is a bestseller. It's on sort of 100 most important books list throughout the 1930s and 1940s. And it's interesting, he spends a lot of time defining the American Dream in the book. He uses the term more than 50 times throughout the 400 pages. But I find it really interesting that he starts by defining it as what it's not. And in 1931, he says the American Dream is not a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they are innately capable, and then be recognized by others for who they are, regardless of the fortuitous circumstances of birth or position. And Adams really felt that what he was trying to define as the American Dream, his version, the ideals of that, not about consumption, not about attainment of status, were really being challenged in the 1920s and during the Great Depression. And so he really was wary of defining the American dream as money-making and materialistic and the extension of that really material narrative. But it wasn't material plenty that drew millions of people to the shores of America, but rather these ideals. And he pulls it, as many people do, from the Declaration of Independence, right? This notion of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he's honest, particularly for the 1930s. He's honest about how complicated this narrative is in terms of American history, in terms that this is built on stolen land, right? That this notion of home ownership and property ownership is often against the land that was taken from the indigenous peoples throughout the early history of America and continues. So he complicates this, but he really wants people to think of this about social order and not about economics.
So this is very complicated. Yeah, it's lofty and thoughtful. And yet, Michael Cauvel, how did we then get redirected away from all of that into the white picket fence and the two cars and this steady job with the nice wage?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to hear Libby say what this explicitly was not in the original conception. And I think that contrasts very heavily with how most people think about that today. And you mentioned, Keith, a question about does it represent freedom to pursue what you want, or does it represent, you know, wealth attainment? And I think for economists, often those two things are more closely intertwined than others might think about it, that what income really gives us is the ability to pursue the options that we want to the most, rather than having our choices constrained. But I think most scholarly conceptions that have traced the evolution of the American dream note that really around the time of the 30s and the 40s, the ideals that Americans had about the shared dream really emphasized things like equality and justice and democracy. But over time, that morphed and became more individualistic and became more materialistic, to the point that the picture of success that we envision is to live with your family in a nice home where you have a lawn that separates you from your neighbors and even a white picket fence to keep other people out. And so it became really about consumption, and it became about the individual rather than the community. It's not about having strong community bonds or helping others or doing meaningful work, but rather to work as hard as you can so that you can consume as much as you can. And I think this really became the favored interpretation at the height of the Cold War, really as a way to signal the superiority of free market capitalism over other competing types of economic and social systems.
Yeah, so Eric Nelson, what it becomes is this focus on the individual. If you work hard, you can, you know, climb past the others. It's Darwinian almost, I guess, in terms of, you know, clawing your way to the top, or social climbing. That sounds like an extreme version of this, but is that the tension that lies within?
Sure. So I teach a couple of classes where my students work with the data and statistics behind this more kind of modern individualistic definition of the American dream. And so, you know, I can get a little into what's been happening over the past 40 or 50 years, you know, given this definition of the new, more modern definition of the American dream. And what my students and I find is that if you were born in 1940, there was a 90% probability that you would out-earn your parents. So with this new modern definition of the American dream, 90% of people born in 1940 were achieving the American dream. Now, more recent data, though, has pointed out that people born in the early 1980s, they're only about 50% likely to out-earn their parents. But I do think there is some nuance, even with the more modern definition of the American dream, where we're not necessarily concerned about what's called absolute achievement of the American dream, whether you out-earn your parents. Because if your parents made $500,000 and you make $450,000, you know, you're achieving the American dream, even though you're not out-earning your parents. So what has become more of the kind of the focus of economists recently and policymakers is what we would call maybe achieving the relative American dream. So what's the probability that a person born in a kind of the bottom fifth of the income distribution would be able to make it to at least middle class, or at least to, or even, you know, higher into the top fifth of the income distribution? And that likelihood has been diminishing over the last 30 or 40 or 50 years. And there's a whole host of reasons that we can get into, but that's kind of where, you know, where my students and I have been doing some research in the last couple of years.
Yeah, and we definitely want to get into this discussion about maybe rethinking the American dream for the future generations. Maybe they're already doing it on their own and don't need our help. Eric, you're talking about the changes. There's a study I just read about this morning out of Harvard that suggests that what America experienced in the post-war decades of the home ownership surging to 20 points in a single generation, and the growth of the middle class was actually not, the argument is, it's not a natural feature of the capitalist economy. It happened because of a set of specific and unrepeatable subsidies of and historical conditions that we could not recreate. And it lists, you know, the GI Bill, union wages, mortgage guarantees, all of that. I'll open it to anyone. That really suggests
what is
that.
Unique about,
yeah, go ahead, Eric.
What's unique about the immediate post-war era is that the economic growth that occurred then was widely shared. It was shared at to a degree that it hadn't been before, nor has it been since. And you mentioned there were a couple of, you know, the GI Bill, and there were some other, you know, policy. And it was just also manufacturing was so important to the U.S. economy. And manufacturing was a great way for someone who was born in a poor household to achieve middle class. So, yes, there were some very unique conditions that existed right after the war. And that, you know, since the manufacturing base has declined since the 1980s, it's hollowed out due, you know, to various reasons. It's been a lot of that economic growth that we experience in this country is not as shared equally as it was post-war.
And does that begin with the globalization, the shift, the movement of manufacturing overseas, Michael? Cobble, is that the beginning of the change?
I think there's a lot of factors that are really interrelated here, and economists and others who have studied these things have a really difficult time separating them because there are so many trends in our restructuring of our economic system that occur around the same time. We have definitely offshoring and globalization that leads to deindustrialization, so a very dramatic drop in the percentage of our economic activity and our jobs that are manufacturing rather than service providing. We also see growth in financialization. Our economy becomes more heavily intertwined with the financial sector and financial systems, and we see declining union rates, and all of these things are really occurring around the same time. And so this typically, we would point to the late 70s and 1980s as periods where we're really starting to see a reversal of that trend of falling income inequality, where we are sharing the gains of our economic success more broadly. That starts to reverse. We also start to see that our growth becomes less dynamic. And so all of these things are really occurring around the same time, and it becomes hard to separate what causes what and what is the impetus.
Libby, go ahead.
I don't want to also lose sight of a lot of the cultural shifts that kind of make and remake this narrative. I mean, I would argue in many ways that each generation remakes the narrative of what the American dream is. And so much of that is fed through the growth of popular culture. And one of the things you see during the Cold War and this emphasis on the nuclear family, you have a massive housing shortage. When the GIs are coming back from war, you have all of these women who have left the home and been brought into the workforce in droves by the hundreds of thousands in new ways. And you have these shifting social tensions, right? Like, if the dream is also partially about political participation, by the 1940s, women have only been able to vote for 20 years. And I think that access of the GI Bill that not only opens up all of these mortgage loans to certain neighborhoods for certain types of families, often depending on your race, but also this wide access to education. And I'm hoping something that we think a little bit more about today in terms of the American dream is how much of that is also realized by public education and people's access to that public education, both K through 12 and undergraduate, because you have tens and hundreds of thousands of people who would not have gone to college before World War II, coming back from the war, going to college, and having access to different types of jobs and manufacturing as well. So the culture is feeding this too. And part of that white picket fence narrative is so much a television narrative, which also comes into play in the 1950s, of constantly seeing this notion of here's what the TV families have, here's what this should be, even if it's not the reality that most people are living.
I want to plug our programming, but also make a point in the conversation. PBS will air a documentary tomorrow at 8 p.m. on the World Channel called Amerigo, The Search for the American Dream, for which I believe 1,000 Americans were interviewed. I don't think they all made the film, but they were asked to describe the American dream. They often, as expected, go to the visual icon of the house with the white picket fence. It's part of the list of the checkoff list. But many interviewed also said that the American dream died a long time ago, or described it as a joke. I want to, I guess, Libby, I guess I'll go back to you here on this. What is your sense based upon your own scan of the world here about how Americans feel about their own dream?
I watched that documentary, actually can recommend. It's wonderful. It's also streaming on MPBN and PBS. And one of the reasons I thought it was so interesting is because of the diversity of voices. And one of the things that the points that emerges out of this documentary is this notion that today the people who are most likely to subscribe to the notion of the American dream that we've been talking about are first generation immigrants and millionaires that still kind of deeply believe in this ability. And I think, you know, as I scan, and particularly as I teach where I do, you know, at a public comprehensive university, one of the things we see people struggle with all the time is this notion that you're fed, you know, growing up, depending on your socioeconomic class and your access to these sorts of things, is that this attainment is for everybody. Anyone can achieve the American dream. If you just do X, Y, and Z things, it's very prescriptive. And I think the reality for people growing up post 9/11, post economic and housing crash and crisis of 2008, COVID, is very much, we've been told we can access this, but it doesn't feel accessible. I'm 31 years old. I'm living with my parents. I can't make rent, even working 2 to 3 jobs. And so I think it's really disheartening, right, for so many people today, economically, to see this and to have been fed this, spoon-fed this dream in their education, in their culture, right, in everything that's surrounding them. And then at every turn in trying to achieve it, not being able to. And in that documentary, nearly every single person under 40 is saying, I can't afford a house. I don't think I'll ever be able to buy a house. And it was striking to me how much buying a house was part of this narrative.
Right. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. We'll talk more about the American dream, and we want you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we're exploring the meaning of the American dream. Joining me, Eric Nelson, professor of economics at Bowdoin College, Libby Bischoff, professor of history at the University of Southern Maine, and Michael Cauvel is an associate professor of economics also at USM. Join the conversation, email talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Eric Nelson, maybe an academic question here, but just testing the American dream, how possible is it for all of us to achieve? In other words, all of us can't succeed, grow. I mean, maybe we can, but how can all of us achieve this dream together? Doesn't somebody have to be left behind to make the economy somehow real?
Well, no. I mean, if the economy grows robustly, we can all share in the growth. Now, and again, this gets to the idea of achieving the dream in a relative sense versus an absolute sense. So, can all Americans have a decent shelter, have decent nutrition, et cetera? Yes, I would assume that that's something that we could strive for and actually get. But yeah, there's some of the things that have emerged recently in this kind of in the data behind this is that where you grow up really matters and your ability to achieve the dream or not. And again, when I say achieve the dream, I mean to have a, what we would call maybe a middle class life. And it appears more and more that the places you grow up have a huge impact on whether you're able to do this or not, even if you do the things that we suggest get you towards that dream, doing well in school, working hard, doing the best you can. So I do think that a lot of Americans don't realize how important kind of the background that you grow up in has in your ability to achieve the dream.
Yeah, this, of course, is a big the phrase is bandied about in politics all of the time. Most recently, we're hearing progressives tapping into this notion that billionaires have rigged the system against the middle class, Bernie Sanders et al., to the detriment of the middle class. But I want to play a clip from another politician at the other end of the political spectrum. This is then candidate Donald Trump in 2015 in his run for presidency. Chris, if we could roll that tape, please.
Sadly, the American dream is dead.
Bring it back.
But if I get elected president, I will bring it back bigger and better and stronger than ever before. And we will make America great again. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So this, the American dream here is at the very foundation of his vision of the MAGA movement. I don't have a question to follow up, but any thoughts that you have? Yeah, Eric?
Yeah, I'll say one thing on that. So the problem is, I think, and Libby kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier, that a lot of the things that we consume that presumably get us towards achieving the American dream have become much more expensive, or the kind of the foundations of the American dream have become riskier. So, for example, in 2024, this was the latest statistic, owning a home was 47% costlier than renting. The relative difference between owning a home and renting have never been higher than that. So, for example, if you pay $20,000 a year in rent, a homeowner is paying $30,000 a year in mortgage, right? Because that's about a 47% difference. So that is, even though there's, all politicians want people under their watch to achieve the dream, if, politicians, individual presidents, for example, can't control the price of housing, or, for example, pensions basically no longer are offered to our younger workers, and all of saving for retirement is done through 401ks, and those are much riskier. So than guaranteed pensions. So the idea of being able to achieve the dream moving forward has got to also, we have to consider the cost of things and the risk that we take on to achieve that. And that's just really difficult for an individual president to control.
Let's,
I think you could do that, Keith. Oh, yeah. Sorry, just Keith with sound bites, like, when Trump was running for office the first time, right? Which is, I think, when that clip came from, right? The first
Yes.
Run. I mean, you could go back to Reagan, you could go back to Clinton, to Bush. I think you could find sound bites of nearly every American politician calling on this notion of the American dream and its relative status and how they're going to impact it one way or another. I find that really interesting as like a cultural touchstone. Mike, go ahead, jump in.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, right, that the terminology here, it's the American dream. It's not the American promise, certainly not the American reality. And we can talk about how it's perhaps become harder to achieve in some ways, but it's also never been the case that it was always easily achievable. There have always been big issues. There have always been people who've been left out. There have always been, cultural representations, not just of this is the dream that we should have, but also how difficult it is to achieve. I think about The Death of the Salesman, the Arthur Miller play from 1949, that is really, in many ways, the era that we think about as being the height of the American dream. The post-war period, we see the kind of rise of consumer products and all of these other things. But even then, there are people who are talking about and reflecting on how difficult it is to get ahead, even if you work as hard as possible.
Let's bring in Jamie from Portland. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to the program.
Well, I'm sorry to sound a little bit more ethereal here, but maybe I can just take the dream as a not so much of an endpoint, but an opportunity to try and to try to fail and not to be stopped from, aspiring to other things in life. I know that I don't know systems like the caste system in India, but to be slotted and say that you're in a not to go down any other roads other than to say that, I'm throwing out income and privilege and how people can get to their picket fence, so to speak. But, first and foremost is a chance to succeed. That to me, I think, is the ultimate dream, is not to be stopped. If you're stopped from doing that, it can feel pretty dark. I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Okay, Jamie. Yeah, thank you. Any comments? Yeah, first, Michael?
Yeah, I would say that I think there's a lot of truth in what Jamie said. And really the root of the American dream in some ways and this idea of social mobility and all of these things stems from the fact that America, in its founding, was a country without, a landed aristocracy, where you did not have inherited titles, where you were not consigned to a particular station in life just by virtue of your birth. But we have had opportunity. But I think the other point I would add is that over time, the degree to which people are rewarded for their hard work, the degree to which America truly is a meritocracy, has changed pretty dramatically, to the point that now I think somebody who's born to the bottom 20% in terms of their parents' income is four times more likely to stay at the bottom than to rise to the top. So there are real questions about the degree to which we do reward people for working hard and pursuing their dreams. And in many ways, these are things that we can control with the policies and the systems and the institutions that we put in place.
Yep. It was interesting, the caller, in terms of the notion, I think, that he was bringing up of like the ability to dream, the ability to aspire, the ability to strive is really important. And I think the loss of faith in one's ability to attain whatever version of the dream you ascribe to or think it's not even possible, and that loss of the ability to dream, I think, is also really significant. I've been thinking about, since you asked me to be on, Langston Hughes has this wonderful poem from the Harlem Renaissance that's "What Happens to a Dream Deferred." And I've been thinking about that a lot in the context of the American dream. Like, what if, if we all don't have the ability for the same type of striving, why do some people have to wait longer to realize it than others? Why are there roadblocks in the way for others? King literally called on the American dream in his 1963 "I Have a Dream" speech. But it's like making real the promises of the Declaration and the founding and racial equality. And until you get that, like, no one can achieve the pinnacle of the dream. So I agree with the caller, like keeping that aspiration is really important. The thing I worry about in 2026 is how much of that is drying up and deferring for people, and they're losing that ability to dream and to hope because the reality makes it seem like it's not possible.
What do you make as economists, not political pundits, but as economists, what do you make of this charge that billionaires are to blame for pulling the rug out from under the middle class and keeping us from our dream?
Well, you can, you know, so again, when you look at the upper end of the income distribution, and we do see that the upper end of the income distribution, their wealth is growing very, very quickly. So, you know, for the American dream aspect, though, we have to ask what's happening at, like, for example, the bottom fifth or the bottom half of the distribution. What's happening to their ability to have a decent life as they grow up? So, you know, to the extent that, so that's a different question, right? Now, you could say that they're intertwined in the sense that if the economy is geared towards rewarding the top fifth, then it's probably not trickling down to like the bottom fifth of the distribution. But so you know, concentrating on the top fifth is, in and of itself, is not necessarily, you know, the fact that they're growing really quickly is not necessarily a sign that the dream is dying for those in the bottom half or the bottom fifth. But, you know, if the economy is geared towards only rewarding those in the top fifth, then it, you know, is probably problematic for the dream for the larger group of Americans.
Yeah. The other part of this idea, not only that you can, once you're here, that you can make a better life for yourself and for your children with hard work, but that you can come here from somewhere else. You know, I think Ronald Reagan said, you know, you can move to Japan, but you're not going to become Japanese. Anyone can move to America and become American and American. And now that also, though, is under intense scrutiny. Who can come here? Who here is allowed to pursue those dreams? Is that not also a part of what Americans are feeling about the American dream that they have, that they were introduced to?
I think that's absolutely right. And I would say that in many ways, these things are intertwined. This idea about what we dream of as those who are born here and what we dream of for those who immigrate here is that no matter who you are, that if you work hard, you can achieve a good, happy life, a good, stable economic life, free from worry about poverty and other things like that. And I think in many ways, we haven't always delivered on that dream, but we have shared that dream more than we, I think, currently do. Perhaps Libby can speak more to that. But I often ask my students in class on the first day, what do you think of the current state of the American economy? Is it healthy? Is it not? And many students who are born here are talking about, oh, it was so much better for my parents' generation than for mine. And then I have students who are refugees who say, what are you all talking about? This place is amazing. Because I came from a war-torn country where no matter what, I, you know, didn't know where my next meal was coming from. And things are so much better here. So I think those different perspectives are always important to consider.
And I think actually that drives some of the discontent, I guess, amongst Americans who have been here for a while. They view sometimes a lot of people will view the American dream as a zero-sum game. So if someone else is achieving the dream, someone can't be achieving the dream, like you spoke to earlier, Keith. So I do think there's some of that idea that if immigrants are coming here and they're achieving the dream, that means there's a certain number of people who have been here for a long time that are not achieving the dream. Now, again, as an economist, I would say that that is not the case at all. Economic growth can be shared broadly amongst the populace like it was in the 1940s. You know, if we can achieve, if we probably adopt certain policies. Now, what those policies are is a bit beyond me and what I've looked at, but.
Yeah, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we want to shift to this idea of redefining, rethinking the American dream. The number to join the conversation, 1-800-399-356. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, we're talking about the American dream, what it's meant in the past, and what it may mean going forward. My guests, USM economist Michael Cauvel, USM historian Libby Bischoff, and Bowdoin economist Eric Nelson, share your comments and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. We will go to Diane in a moment. But as we begin this shift toward revisioning the American dream, I think about what the next generation has gone through already. We mentioned the pandemic. They're facing the uncertainty around climate change and the technological uncertainties around AI and what that means for what people will do for work going forward. These are major questions, and I wonder if it will have automatically then made them think about what it is they see as the American dream. Libby, I'll start with you.
Sure, and I think we're always called upon to rethink these notions every time there's a major anniversary, like America 250, like the bicentennial, like the centennial. I was sitting down for dinner with my 14-year-old last night and talking to him about this, and he was talking about AI and all of these challenges and, you know, what does this even all mean anymore to someone who's 14 years old and growing up in the face of this. And one of the things we talked about is this notion of the ways in which people are starting to re-realize the importance of community and local, and like where change is actually possible, and how people can get involved in making life better for their neighbors around them. A big part of the documentary Amerigo features people on cell phones all the time and talks about the ways in which technology and the internet and social media have made us more isolated and alone. So for me, as I'm rethinking this and thinking about the possibilities of what this dream might mean, it's not so much the achievement of the individual, but it's thinking a lot more about community and reconnection and what it means to be a good neighbor in every sense of that word, in looking out for one another and to physically reconnect in an age where we are supposedly more connected than ever via technology, but human interaction is so challenged. So for me, that's what's top of mind.
Yeah, Eric Nelson, you said you talk about this a lot in your classes.
So it is interesting. In 2008, college grads earned twice as much as high school grads, but recently that has only gone, that kind of above and beyond earning power is two-thirds, right? So it's not twice as much. It's only about 67%. So we do see that the premium to college education versus high school education is declining. So, and to the extent that, you know, entrepreneurs will be able to create businesses using AI without any college degree, it is an interesting question of the how important a college degree will be moving forward, especially if some of the tasks that college degrees were, you know, used for in the past, like accounting, et cetera, are done by AI. You know, where does the high valued work come from? Are we going to see a switch to the trades where, you know, electricians, et cetera, are actually the ones who are most likely to earn more than their parents or be able to achieve the middle, you know, kind of the middle class? So it is an interesting, you know, I have a son who's 18, and I do worry too about, you know, what kind of work can he do in the future when so much of the kind of the, you know, computer-based work and a lot of the kind of white-collar work could be potentially to some extent replaced by large language models.
Let's go to Diane, who is calling from Chibeague Island. Hi, Diane. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I would just like to bring up a couple of things I learned in college courses, and I was interested in history and also public policy. So one course I took was actually business and public policy, and it was, I mean, I learned just a couple of tenets that I'll never forget. Primarily that basically, in as much as new Americans had thrown off George III and you know, rejected that kind of caste system, they just really wanted nothing from government, and basically business kind of took a foothold. And then I guess the government really had to play catch up finally. But so it was just kind of cleaning the streets from horse manure. That was the what the new Americans were kind of thinking was valuable, but then they just did not want to be interfered with economically. And then the other thing I remember having learned was that John Adams actually was very disheartened following the revolution and, you know, the new freedoms realized by American citizens, in as much as he was thinking that they were just going to be thrilled about all their political freedoms. And really, when he went amongst his neighbors and the community he lived in and that, he just kind of found that they were more interested in economic freedom than they were in the square, you know, the common ground that you could find there. And it was just money grubbing primarily. So I thought there was kind of an intersection between these two things, you know, regulatory stuff, and then also just this business of business, you know.
Yeah. Diane, thank you very much for your call. Any thoughts from the group? That's okay. Okay, let's go. Let's bring in another call. I want to bring in a few calls here, which have been building up here. We have Lee calling from Bridgeton. Hi, Lee. Welcome.
Hi. I just have a few comments. Remember, we're living in a country that still has a federal minimum wage of just over $7, and no wonder people really can't get ahead. The size of houses that are being constructed compared to the size of houses that were built in the 50s and 60s, you know, 3-4 bedrooms and baths accompany them. Those are designed to be built for people with lots and lots of money. They're not houses that are, you know, to get in for your first time. The size of automobiles, the same thing has happened there. These huge, gigantic, expensive $50,000 trucks. So the options, you know, become more frustrating. Usury fees, the cost of borrowing money. And I just got a notice the other day that if I make a payment late, it's now $41, plus the fact that I have to pay the extra interest. And the last thing I would bring up is the cost of health care that is a for-profit mode. So all of these things greatly impede the ability of people in our country to move forward and move into the middle class. Thank you.
It's also, I did want to bring this up, that there is a way maybe that the future generations will not want to live in a giant house and maintain a giant house, have a big car that might consume a lot of gas or electricity, and, you know, they want to be more sort of live job to job, live by have more adventure. Maybe that's more of a priority than the stable, steady income with the giant anchor house. Yeah, Michael.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I would also point to the notion that maybe our shared vision, this American dream, is in some ways responsible for the things that we think we want. We're told that what the picture of success is, it's to have a large house and to have a car, multiple cars and large cars, and to have a lot of money, rather than to have, you know, a really interesting job, a really interesting life, to have meaningful connections with people around you. So if we're thinking about perhaps redefining the American dream, maybe we can try and do that in a way that kind of urges people to pursue the types of things not only that might make them happy, and that research on what makes people happy shows does make them happy, but also what's going to improve the lives of those around them and to improve our communities and our society.
And speaking to the future, it is true that the average American household size is falling due to decreases in fertility. So it could be that, younger people today, as they grow up, they are interested in smaller homes, smaller cars, just because they don't have as many kids. And so they don't need these larger suburban homes. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that there's more construction of smaller homes. And some car companies have expressed over the last year or so some regret in abandoning some of those smaller cars that they used to build for $25,000, $30,000. So we may see, this is, I guess, the great thing about capitalism. Supposedly the producers will respond to changes in household size and changes in the ability to consume due to constrained incomes and, start producing smaller and cheaper options.
There's also a lot of conversation about creating car-free communities, being able to walk to where you want to go to be able to connect with other people. This is actually really desirable for a lot of people. So being isolated in a house in the suburbs that you need a car to get to and from is in fact not the American dream for them. And I just wonder whether how our lives evolve in terms of these new infrastructures based upon, it's a big topic and we only have 5 minutes left, but some of this may be decided for us and we may adopt the changes in that way.
And some of this we are living with the ramifications of different choices, right? So like if you look at how South Portland is and you look at the mall and the airport and all of those things, that isn't accidental. That's a product of 1940s, 1950s consumer culture shift, the building of highways. So there were all these transportation decisions made at the local, state, and federal levels in the 1950s that totally affect how we live today. I'm a 19th century cultural historian. It's 1909. I go anywhere in Maine, I'm gonna hop on a trolley or a train and get nearly anywhere else. And you don't have that same kind of mobility because the emphasis was on cars and travel. And so you get the actual, not just the decline of rail, but like taking away those options for this very public form of transportation. So I think people in the 21st century forget a lot how much choice people in the 19th and 20th century made and how much action they took to change the structure of where they were living and what it looked like, and that we also can do that in maybe more sustainable ways, in maybe ways that aren't tearing apart neighborhoods or like doing this in a way that's discriminatory, right? But these are all products of choices that people made and that can be made again and again and again over time. I mean, otherwise historians wouldn't have anything to study.
We've got 1 minute left. Robert, if you can be quick, we'll bring you in. Welcome. From Robert from Belfast.
Yeah, fellas, thanks. Nice program. Listen, a big problem here is expectations, too. We come mostly from Europe and from other places. And expectations for Europeans 100, 200, 300 years ago in feudal society didn't include owning a home at all. That was just a dream. And when they came here, those expectations were sort of increased because of the opportunities, but there's a big problem with that too. So different places, different immigrants, different expectations are part of it too. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you, and Matt, thanks for being brief there, Robert. We are unfortunately out of time. We could go and we could talk about this for many, many more hours. So I want to thank you all for joining us here today. Eric Nelson is a professor of economics at Bowdoin College. Michael Cauvel is an associate professor of economics at the University of Southern Maine. And Libby Bischoff is also with USM, where she is a professor of history. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Summer Gardening Advice. I'm Keith Shortall, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.